me. If you ever get to California, you have to see the Big Sur coast.
Hello, welcome to a Big Sur podcast. This is episode 83. I am Magnus Torren, the host of the podcast. And this time I'm having a conversation with John and Corrine Handy of Three Bones Resort down on what locally is known as the Big Sur South Coast. We will talk about a few things. You know, you can't get too much into 1 hour, but we cover some interesting things about John and Corrine's life prior to coming to Big Sur and the genesis of Three Bones, a place that many of us are familiar with, of course, here along the coast. I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. Thank you for listening.
And we're going to scoot off to California for a little while, and we'll be back to Canada at some point. But here we are, you know, 40 years later, never went back to our home.
And so it wasn't something we asked for or expected or planned for, but that's what we ended up with, a piece of property that was zoned commercial. A key to being an inventor or creator of things is optimism, but it can get you into big trouble. I guess my biggest talent really was thinking like a seven-year-old. I saw those turtles for exactly what they were. Courage is more important to a little boy than power, money, fame, anything. But inside of them is a little hero. Yeah. And I guess in my heart, I knew it. What we wanted to do is perch lightly on the land. But it was really a five-year process just to get the permits. And it passed by one vote. So we were one vote away from having the dream of Three Bones completely torn down.
Hello, John.
Hey, Magus.
How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. Where are you?
We're at Three Bones.
Okay. Corrine is with you?
Yes. She's just joining.
All right. Corrine, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks, Magnus. I'm here.
Good morning. Do you guys have some good coffee?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. So it's sort of odd that I guess it isn't odd, but it's been so long since we saw each other physically, because in part, of course, because of the slide and the closure of the road.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a very unusual and challenging year for sure.
Yeah. I'd be interested actually to hear you just talk briefly about that to start with, because it is something that everybody is concerned with on the coast, of course, and we think of you often down there.
Well, the toughest part of the year was actually the first 6 months, because the road was closed both north and south of Three Bones, so nobody could get in as far as guests go. We had some limited in and out access, but that was even tough. So for 6 months, we were closed, lost half a year of revenue, and we still had our staff staying at Three Bones. They have the employee housing. So that was tough. And then it opened up for us in late June, but only from the south. So only people either coming directly from the south could get in, or if anyone from San Francisco area or north would have to go all the way around down the 101 and cut across on the 46 and come up.
Yeah.
But that was enough to at least keep us open and keep us partially occupied. And that's been our year so far. Now we're waiting for the closure from the north to open up at Paul's Slide. Hopefully they'll get to that by this winter.
Right. I mean, you and I spoke of it recently that there would be a possibility for opening up for a passage at certain hours a day before they open up completely.
Yeah, that just never materialized. The Caltrans is working hard on the slide, but they're not very cooperative as far as some partial local traffic. Even though the contractors drive back and forth across that slide, they don't open it up to the locals. And frankly, it's been difficult not having mail directly delivered to us for a year.
Right. Jeez. Yeah.
All kinds of things. It's a very big challenge. I think it'd be unusual for anybody to be cut off like that.
Right. So Andrew doesn't feel like driving around?
No. Yeah. I mean, they could come a little bit further. They dropped the mail at Ragged Point, and Caleb, our son-in-law, who's part of Big Sur Fire, is the one most of the time who's picking up that. We're talking about U.S. mail. So goes down and he picks up mail for ourselves and Pacific Valley School. I think he does that, and also for the Caltrans people,
right,
and comes up in packages. And then, you know, it's interesting how agencies like UPS and FedEx, there seems to be, you know, always an inability to solve any kind of problem that's too complex. So, you know, they can't seem to reroute our UPS, because the UPS truck could come up from the south. But if it lands in the north, then it ends up, it's just kind of a funny rigmarole. But so fortunately, we have a general manager that's working for us who's living in Cambria, but her house has become a way station for all UPS and FedEx packages for both our business and also for our 30 employees.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because her husband works out of the home. So half the day he's running down there and signing for packages.
How long ago is it that you guys opened Three Bones?
It'll be 20 years in November of next year. So it's been 19 years so far.
Yeah. Did you, when you were sitting around, you know, having fun thinking about opening up this remarkable place that you did open up, and you were in your planning stages, which I assume must have been a really fun time, you know, sitting there at the table and, you know, coming up with ideas and looking to the future. Did you ever think that you were going to be, I mean, kind of a silly question, I guess, but did you think that you were going to be closed off like this? Because you've been now quite a few times.
Well, interestingly enough, when Karina and I got married, it was 1983, and you'll recall that that's the year that the highway closed, like it is now, closed in both directions from the landslides.
Big one, right.
So we were on our honeymoon, and we were gleefully driving down the coast, stopping at all, you know, beautiful towns along the way. We had 2 weeks to get to L.A., and we pulled through Monterey and got all the way to the north part of Big Sur, and there was a big sign saying it's closed. So it was actually, in answer to your question, we should have been aware that this was possible. But of course, when dreaming about your what you're going to do, you always include all the things it could.
So we were one of those. We were just the same as every other tourist, because we were actually moving from Canada to LA for John to begin his career as a toy designer. But so we were exactly like other tourists that either didn't look at something, or that landed, you know, at the closed place and then had to backtrack.
Right.
But really it was it inspired, you know, like, so there was a large portion of Big Sur we never saw that on that honeymoon trip. But once we landed in LA, it was really the thing that caused us to be even more curious about coming back up and seeing this part of the coast that we'd heard so much about, which we did, you know, as soon as it was more open.
Right. So pardon me. So this honeymoon trip was going to be the first time for you to actually see Big Sur?
That's right.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Never seen
it. I had worked in a, when I was backpacking in Europe several years before that, it was very strange because I was, we were staying at a hostel, my friend and I, and this person we met from Ohio, I remember him saying so clearly to me, if you ever get to California, you have to see the Big Sur coast. And it was so foreign to me at the time. I'd really only come once down for Disneyland when I was 12, and that was it. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. That was years before. I'd probably forgotten it. But
where in the world? Where in the world was that hostel? You were in Europe?
It was in Switzerland.
Switzerland, okay.
That was way before John and I were even, you know, together or had no plans of, you know, being in California. But it's interesting. Years later, here we were coming down the coast.
Yeah.
Couldn't see most of Big Sur. And then we landed in L.A. and began our jobs there. We spent most of our weekends coming back up. And of course, because we were in L.A., most of our stays were focused here on the South Coast, which we readily fell in love with. And every campsite along this coast, and spent so many times.
Where did you come from originally? In Canada somewhere, you said?
Yeah, just outside of Vancouver, British Columbia on the West Coast.
Huh.
Okay. So that's where I grew up and went to college there. And that's where I met John in British Columbia, just outside of Vancouver, in a small town called Langley.
Wow! And John, where did you grow up?
I grew up the first 12 years of my life in San Jose, and my dad was a teacher. And then when I was 12, we moved to Canada, and I spent 7 years in Canada, and that's where I met Corinne.
Also on the west coast or west side.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So you guys met how?
Well, you're in high school. Corinne showed up out of nowhere.
Well, that's not really. I was. I transferred schools. My parents had moved to the country.
Yeah. But from my standpoint, there's a new girl in the school, kind of a country school out there. And she was intriguing, a little bit shy. But I had my eyes on her. But we didn't actually get together and start dating until I had already left Canada and gone to Arizona State University. And then we started dating when I would come home at Christmas and stuff. And so it was, we met each other in high school, but we can't call each other high school sweethearts. She would really not have much to do with me.
Okay. So when you were down in Arizona, you did not have any kind of correspondence. So it just only happened when you were up there.
Yes. That's right.
Okay.
He went to college. His dad was my faculty advisor. His dad was a professor. That's what took them from San Jose to Canada.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed his dad. He was just a very significant person in my life as a young adult, and I just treasured his friendship.
What subject did he teach?
What did he teach?
He was lower division college science teacher.
Uh huh. Okay.
He'd teach the first 2 years of geology and, you know, chemistry and right. biology.
Yeah, I never really had him as a professor, but I was on the commuter committee because I commuted into school. So he was the faculty advisor, and that's how we got to know each other and spent lots of times sitting in his office, you know, drinking tea or whatever. But
it doesn't do much good when your professor recommends his son to date, because that sounds sort of desperate.
Well, also... crazy car with big fat mag tires in the winter time, which I thought was so highly impractical, Magnus. So
okay. I was impractical, but maybe Corinne was
too practical.
Right, so, right. Sounds like a good combo.
Correct.
So what happens then? You go start dating. I'm just curious about how long it is between that then and when 1983 rolls around. It's a little period there, right?
Yeah, it was a bit of a period, like 4 years that transpired, 3 or 4 years.
He was down.
I will say that even Corinne and I were dating, and I don't tell the story because Corinne doesn't like it, but we didn't hit it off right away. So it took some false starts. And then I think what happened is somewhere along your life, you realize the person you've been waiting for, I'll speak for Corinne, but maybe the person you were waiting for was right there all the time. Yeah. And you didn't really realize that some, you know, silly guy with a funny sense of humor and love for you know, fast cars and stuff was actually something that might be good for you. Uh-huh. I recognize Corinne would be good for me a lot sooner than she recognized I'd be good for her. I think one thing that I could say is that I'm pretty persistent, and I had to be with dating Corinne because it wasn't easy.
Could you describe then how it is that he managed to convince wouldn't even be the right word. Persistence means that he was, you know, his way of approaching you became sort of overwhelming in the end, and you sort of gave in. Is that true?
The perspective that we have now, being married 40 years and looking back to that, is of course very different than maybe what perspective was at that time. But I would say that, you know, and maybe dating's changed and people look at life partners different. But I think back then, you know, in our early 20s, we were seriously thinking about, you know, who we could move through life with. And, you know, I had dated other people, but there was something about John. He was very grounded. We shared a faith together. He was someone that he never ruffled my feathers. You know, he was someone that when he was in my life, he took me as I was, and he seemed to know who I was right away. And so in today's language, I probably assumed and knew he had quite a high level of emotional intelligence. And I think I appreciated that about him, even though he's crazy cars and loved cars and fat mag tires on skiddy, icy roads. Is the prankster on our college campus. I guess I saw right from the beginning that he was also a person of high integrity and someone that I could trust and rely on. And I guess I pretty much knew that right from the beginning, but it just took a little longer or something. So, yeah.
And then he actually asked you to marry him, and you became a couple. And not that how long after you got married did you become a family, your firstborn? What is the time there?
Yeah. But, you know, the significant thing, Magnus, is that we were engaged and married in Canada, and it was our honeymoon that moved us to California, you know. And so it's, you know, my mom always says she knew the minute that we got married or that we got engaged or married and moved to LA that we would probably never come back to Canada. And I didn't know it at the time. I thought, oh, this is pretty fun. You know, John's got this job offer with Mattel Toys, and we're going to scoot off to California for a little while, and we'll be back to Canada at some point. But here we are, you know, 40 years later, never went back to our roots, my roots. Yeah. So there's a sense of immigration there into the U.S., which now I've become an American citizen. I have a dual citizenship. But so from the time that we got married and honeymooned down the coast, then when there was about 5 years before we welcomed Megan into our life down in LA.
Do you remember, sorry, there's kind of a, you don't have to answer this or talk about this if you don't want to, but I'm just curious about how you felt that time when you discovered that you were pregnant with the person that you loved. How was that moment? Do you remember?
Oh, I mean, I think it was pretty exciting.
We purposely waited 5 years after we got married before we that was our plan. And we realize now that some people to sort of say, hey, you could turn the switch on in 5 years and then we'll get pregnant. Not everyone gets pregnant just when they want to. But I think we made a good choice. We wanted 5 years of just spending with each other and getting to know each other. And I knew that starting at my career at Mattel would be quite busy. There was a lot of travel involved, and there was a lot of maybe late night hours and things as I was coming up to speed on my career. And Corinne was also working hard. She had a good job at a Japanese trading company, and she was doing good work. So we spent that 5 years just as a couple. And
you know,
then
we were having a lot of fun in Los Angeles. To go from a country life in Canada and land smack dab in the middle of Los Angeles was an interesting situation. But I have to say that over the years we lived there, we really learned to love that the areas, the buzz, the way the city really at that time, I don't know, maybe it's changed. We've been here now 20 years, but, you know, it was a very, you know, of course, LA is just a really mixed bag of everything, everybody, everything. And it's very stimulating in that way.
I would say that, you know, buying property in Big Sur was not us running away from our home in Long Beach and our lifestyle there. We loved it. But we asked the question in that 5-year period of time when we were just together as a couple is, well, we're living in Los Angeles because of our jobs. But what if we didn't have those? Where would we live? Where would we find ourselves like retiring to or being once the job part's over? And we said the Central Coast. We didn't say Big Sur necessarily right away, but the Central Coast of California had what we wanted. And we started looking. Started looking at property, even though we had just bought our first house and we didn't really have much money. We looked, and then we found this this parcel right here in South Coast of Big Sur. And we didn't know a lot about the zoning. And we had a real estate agent that said, before you actually put your money down on it, you better find out what the restrictions are. Well, strangely enough, Kareen contacted Monterey County, and they sent us back a letter saying that they thought we already owned it, but they said, here's the land use plan that was just ratified. It was 1987 that we bought the property. So 86, 87, the land use plan was ratified, the Big Sur land use plan. And your property is slated to be rezoned commercial, which we had no idea.
And well, we didn't own it yet.
And here's what it would be, serving commercial. And that would be, if it passed, that would be its designation. So we looked up what that meant. And it did it. About a year later, it passed. And the land use plan was ratified. And our property had been rezoned because it was a piece of property that had road access off of Highway 1. I think in the land use plan, they were thinking that these motels, maybe on the side of Highway 1, we had enough of those. What we needed is places that maybe weren't right on the highway and impeding the view. And we had a road that got right to the back of Tree Bones. It was all overgrown, but that was there. And so it wasn't something we asked for or expected or planned for, but that's what we ended up with, a piece of property that was zoned commercial.
Wow. You said that you did that despite not having a lot of money at the time. Then I know you and I, and I've heard this story before, and I so enjoy hearing your story about how that situation changed thanks to your creativity at your job. Could you tell that story?
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing, Magnus, is a key to being an inventor or creator of things is optimism, but it can get you into big trouble. And I did something, and Kareen, we both agreed to do it, but it was so risky. When I think back on it, I just think it was the silliest thing we could have ever done. And we scraped up 10% and put 10% down on this property. And then we took an interest-only loan with a balloon payment after 5 years of the entire principal. And where the optimism led to ever thinking that was going to be possible was crazy. At that exact time, I had left Mattel for a year, and I'd just gone back to Mattel. But during the year I left, I went to a little toy company called Playmates Toys, and we launched the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And although it hadn't hit the shelves yet, I had great optimism that, number one, it was going to be a big hit, and number two, that when Mattel recognized that I'd worked on it and been partly responsible for the success, that they would reward me. Both of those things happened, but to expect it was crazy. But during that 5-year period of time, when the loan was maturing, we were able to put the money aside. And we actually, the sellers actually asked if they could extend it another 5 years. So we did that too, but we put the money aside and we paid off our loan on the property, and we owned it.
The funny thing about that story is that the couple that sold us the land, of course, because you can't really get a bank loan on blank land, they were a retired couple in Arizona. And I don't know, I mean, this was so long ago now, but I don't even know, you know, why they owned the property or what was their original dream or thoughts about this piece. But then when we did end up finally paying that loan off, which was, you know, like John said, quite a scraping of, you know, the skin of our teeth. They couldn't find the deed. They couldn't find the paper deed on the property. And, you know, of course, we were still in our 20s. We didn't really know, like, what do you do in this case? Someone said we had to get an attorney, which we went down to this little law office down the street in Long Beach. And this man wrote up a letter, of course, telling them, you know, it's highly illegal to, you know, have something for sale like that and then not be able to produce the deed. So, of course, they found it very quickly. But it was a funny time because, you know, it had taken so much for us to actually get to where we were. And then, you know, to have it where, you know, they couldn't even produce a piece of paper that proved we actually paid for it was a little scary for a minute there. But
wow.
Yeah.
Our parents were worried about us, like, what were we doing it? And Kareen's dad's was a very practical man. And he said, you know, you don't really have a water well on that property. You don't really know for sure if there's going to be water. There was a seasonal well that was dry most of the time, and it was a shallow well. So we didn't know about the water, and we also didn't understand about the landslides and instability of property. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, Tree Bones is on a shelf on a bedrock that's about 200 feet below Tree Bones. And that shelf of bedrock collects a lot of water, very pure, very fresh, and it also stabilizes the land. So we have slides to the north of us and slides to the south of us, but Tree Bones, the land has never moved since we've owned it. So both of those things were things we were ignorant about. You know, God bless it.
You mentioned your optimism, and yeah. I'm kind of shaking my head and laughing here because there are people are then. Your parents, your in-laws, people around you are shaking their heads, saying to you, what are you doing buying this property out there, risking all your money? And then the other optimism that I know was also in you mentioned the Ninja Turtles, and I remember that also had people, in my opinion, for very obvious reason, shaking their heads. I mean, I still can't get over the idea that someone, and I think you were instrumental in having that happen, would be so optimistic as to think that these little turtles would become the second greatest toy ever in history.
Yeah, I had
that optimism.
I had a fun career. But I guess my biggest talent really was thinking like a 7-year-old kid, which is also one of the reasons Kareen was kind of questionable about whether I'd make a good spouse. I could think like a 7-year-old kid. I saw those turtles for exactly what they were. A little boy respects this attribute and lacks it in the most amount, and that, and I'm not saying that very clearly, but it's courage.
Yeah.
Courage is more important to a little boy than power, money, fame, anything. Courage is the thing that they lack, but inside of them is a little hero. And those turtles, being teenagers, being unlikely, slow moving creatures, fighting ninja fights, and also making wisecracks and jokes as it's all happening, they exhibited great amount of courage that a 7-year-old boy would exactly understand. And the comic book had never been exposed to children at that time because it was an adult, black and white adult underground comic. But when we modified the story and made it brighter and more acceptable, it really was a phenomena.
Yeah.
And I guess in my heart, I knew it because if it got on the shelves, and the cartoon show got out, it was going to be huge, and it really was in the end.
Right. Do you know? Do you remember Well, I guess it's a long story, but do you remember sort of any moments during the time of discussing spending money on this new toy that were sort of pivotal, that this was the meeting that made people change their mind? What is it that you or someone said that made people?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of documentaries and stuff on the turtles, and I'm interviewed a few times, but the real story was when we showed it to the company, I ran around. There's only 40 people that worked at Playmates Toys. And so I thought all 40 of them should come and see this product line we're about to show, because it's going to be huge. And I invited everyone to the meeting. And when we showed the product line, which is, we had sculpted articulated turtles, we had drawings of the play sets and all the other things, it was dead silent. And it was like, I was the most shocked in the world that they didn't see it for what it was. And I remember the sales guy said the most outlandish comment that really made me upset. He said, "I don't even think the kid in Texas knows what a sewer is, and those turtles lived in sewers." I thought, what? Chiming in against it. But I learned something from that, too, because not everybody understood why we were interested in the turtles and why that they would make a good action figure line. And I think that's the part that I failed to present. And I never did that mistake again. I never presented anything without stating the problem.
And getting the context of it.
In the context or the background, because you can't assume that everyone is on the same page and knows what you know. Never did that. I just showed it. And so I learned something very valuable. And then it was 2 weeks later, Toys R Us visited Playmates to see whatever we had to offer. And the head of marketing, Richard Salas, who did like the turtles, he told us to go and present it to Toys R Us. And they loved it. They thought it was fantastic. But that got people thinking, well, maybe we missed something, you know?
Right, and
that's what happened.
Yeah. And at this time, you guys are still in Long Beach, of course.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and still no children in the family yet.
1988, Megan was born.
88, so, okay.
Right around there. Yeah.
Just mm-hmm. around that time.
When we were looking in Big Sur for property, and we're looking around, Corinne was pregnant with Megan.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this brings us up to Big Sur, and to me, it is impressive. Number one, and I'm sure there must be millions of stories and challenges that you were faced, because you were having Megan. And I don't know how long after that the next kid is coming, but you end up having four children, and you're having four children in the midst of some of the most sort of demanding periods of all of Treebones, certainly, right? You build the whole place at the same time as you have kids running around.
It's true. Not those first years, though. You know, the first years when we were actually having the kids, we had the land, of course, but you know, we didn't have the means or the wherewithal or even the understanding of exactly how we would put it all together at that point. So we would come up here with the kids, you know, like, even though we had a very, you know, busy and fun life down in LA, Treebones and Big Sur was always woven into it. So, you know, we would come up here. Sometimes we would camp at Plaskett for Thanksgiving. We'd bring friends up. We'd have big Thanksgiving potlucks at the campsite. And then, you know, if we could, we would tromp over and look at the property, although it was almost inaccessible at that time with brush and overgrowth. So in those early years when we were raising the kids, it was really still not, it was just a pipe dream. And we were pretty embedded with life down there.
So you were camping basically up.
Sorry?
You were sort of camping at the property in those days.
Right. Yeah. But yeah. And sometimes in the property, a lot of times we would camp at Plaskett because we didn't have, you know, even good poison oak proof access.
Right.
You know, we would camp at Plaskett Creek, or we'd camp at Lime Kiln, and we camped at all the campsites on the South Coast here and hiked all those trails with the kids when they were little and spent a lot of time at Sand Dollar Beach. Yeah.
Well, a few years after we bought Treebones, we met a local, you know, a local guy, Phil Taylor. Mm-hmm. And he had a backhoe, and he wanted to be our caretaker, and we agreed to that. And in exchange, he did clear the road for us, and we were able to drive into to the property, and it was completely overgrown. Nothing was ever built up on the bluff. There was a sawmill down in the lower where the parking lot is right now, but up on the bluff, no one ever really cleared it or did anything. And we wanted to be very judicious about it. And I was incredibly allergic to poison oak, and Crean was too, but I think I was really allergic to it. But what we ended up doing is we went from pine tree to pine tree, kind of connect the dots, and we cut the lower branches off the pine tree, which let them spread their needles further. And we noticed that that would kill poison oak around the tree. And then we'd hack a trail from tree to tree. And then all of a sudden we started realizing, oh my gosh, the views here at Tree Bones are so much better than we ever even imagined. And we're sitting in our house right now, but I remember landing on this spot, and you're kind of on Cape San Martin. So you're looking and you have these views that go all the way around the entire house, which is round. We didn't know it. We hadn't seen even that. So it was like a huge added bonus. And it made us feel even more interested in doing the right project here. But, yeah, you know, had to wait. We knew
there's a lot of years there, but yeah, we had a lot of fun coming onto the South Coast and just exploring.
Wow. So what was the first thing you actually built on the property then? Well, first of all, actually, before I know this already, but can you repeat where the name Tree Bones come from?
Right. And, you know, when we first looked at this property, it's because we were staying with an artist friend that John knew from Mattel, and he was living in Cambria. And we were just dreaming, and we tromped up here, and we had the parcel number, and I think we pulled into Gorda and asked somebody if they actually knew where this parcel number of land was. And someone said, oh, that's the old Tree Bones site. And so you're like, oh, Tree Bones, what was that? And then I don't remember exactly who explained to us at that time that Patrick Cassidy had lived on this property and had developed a wood mill. And he was at that time, U.S. Forestry was allowing people to drag deadwood out of the U.S. forest. And so he had an old makeshift mill on property. This was back in the 70s or 60s, right, honey? Mm-hmm. And so he was milling it into usable lumber. And then, you know, of course, that's why people started calling the site affectionately Tree Bones, because he had all these silvery tree bones lying around on the lower part of the site here. You know, that we discovered that when we first came up here, and someone mentioned to us, yes, indeed, that parcel number has that, you know, sort of coined name Tree Bones. And
it's like the, you know, southern states, the properties had names, not necessarily addresses. And there was no address on this property. But I like the idea that a piece of property had a personality and a name based on its history.
Mary Lou tells me that it was known down on the South Coast as Tree Bones Wood or Tree Bones Woods.
Okay.
Interesting.
Tree Bones Wood. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, years later, when we finally did develop our plan for the resort, we told our friends we were going to keep the name Tree Bones, and some people didn't like it. They're like, oh, it sounds so, I don't know what, they just didn't like the name, but there is absolutely no way it would have been anything other than this name.
Really. It's a perfect name. Yeah. So what was the first thing you actually ended up building on the property then?
Oh, we did a, you know, we had about 15 years of dreaming, and we didn't start out with the idea of building yurts or anything on the property, but we did have a notion that what we wanted to do is perch lightly on the land. So build things on stilts and not flatten everything out, not build any large, hotel like units, but build them small. So we did put up one test yurt. We put it up to see how it would work on the property, see if we can make it comfortable. And that was the first thing we did. And then we decided that that was going to be our main unit. And
was that yurt from Pacific Yurts, or where was that manufactured?
Yeah, it was
20-foot a yurt.
Yeah, I mean, the yurts are a lot more, of course, known now, but back then they weren't really as, you know, well known or as people having familiarity with them. But both of our parents seen them in Oregon at different campsites when they'd been driving back and forth in their visits to us in California, and both sets of our parents had mentioned yurts to us, and so we had looked at them And we bought that.
Yeah.
We bought that one. And a friend of ours was working with us. Jay came up and, you know,
put it up
in a rainstorm.
Yeah. I drove up. I don't remember now what town it was in Oregon where I picked up our yurt probably around 89, 90.
Pacific yurts or?
It was a Pacific yurt. Yeah.
Yeah. That's Grove, Oregon.
Good company.
Yeah. Yeah,
really good.
Yeah,
company.
Yeah. So
what happened with us is once we decided to move forward, right, after that year, we were going to move forward with designing and just implementing the plan at Tree Bones. We hired a good architect firm, Fletcher and Hardowin, in Monterey. And we had our designs, but it was really a 5-year process just to get the permits. So we spent 3 years working with Monterey County, going over all the details, and they took it very seriously. It was unanimously approved by Monterey County, and then it was appealed by the Coastal Commission. So it took an additional 2 years. Didn't really realize how much pressure I was under during that time, but we had spent our savings working through the process. It was quite expensive to get the permits. And then it rested on a final decision with the Coastal Commission after 2 years of working with them. And it was a hearing with the 12 commissioners. They voted and it passed by one vote. So we were one vote away from having the dream of Tree Bones completely torn down and passed by one vote. I remember Potter was one of the commissioners. And one thing he said was, "The strangest thing about this Tree Bone project is the total lack of opposition from the local community." And that was an amazing thing, that our local community supported us with this venture. We introduced ourselves and the project to our community at the school.
The Jade Fest.
They had a fair. It wasn't the Jade Fest. It was a spring fair that they had. But we rented a booth and we rolled our plans out and exposed what we were doing. And people asked us questions. And one of the big questions was, who's going to build it? We would like it to be local people. We agreed to that. And that worked out really well. Peter Lutz was our contractor, local builder. And he hired lots of really skilled people that lived on the South Coast and the North Coast of Big Sur. But we had probably about 40 different construction workers that worked on it. They would work on it for 6 months or a year. And then they'd make enough money that they didn't have to do it anymore. So the next group would come in. But it was kind of a beautiful thing because we did follow through exactly on what we said to our community. And that was a good start, I think, for us.
What was the tension, John, when you said that one vote was the deciding factor? What was the tension on those two sides, let's say?
I don't fully understand it. I know that the idea to appeal the project came from the Coastal Commission office in Santa Cruz, not the commissioners themselves. And we had an interesting meeting with them. And the big thing that caused them to want to stop our project was the dream of the Coastal Trail, actually. And they felt like if we got this approved, we would never allow the Coastal Trail through Tree Bones property. Mm. And so that's what caused it to start. We worked through that concept with them. And then as far as the commissioners themselves, I think there was at that time, it's probably still similar, but there was this fear that these yurts are going to be too easy to put up. Everyone's going to want to do that now. And also they just didn't really want to do much development on the Big Sur coast. I think we're going to be the last probably hotel that gets approved in Big Sur in at least the foreseeable future.
Right. But you were in within the land use plan numbers, right? Obviously this was already I missed that last, John. You got disconnected.
I just said we followed the land use plan exactly.
Right.
And the other thing is that they were used to people not following the design that they got approved and veering off of it. But I would say that that's not what we did. We followed that design. And in the end, the Coastal Commission and Monterey County, I think we're very proud of what Tree Bones became, because it's an ecotourism destination, which is really proper for Big Sur.
Right.
You know, it's lightly on the land. People
enjoy, I mean, it's like, it's never changed as far as like when people come here, the things that they experience is the same still today. You know, they enjoy the being able to actually see the stars at night, enjoy the local hikes. I mean, it's, you know, it's the same eco experience. Yeah. Even though it felt like when we first opened, there was a tension where, you know, you get people coming who, you know, they want this, they want that. We were always reading guests' comments, you know, I mean, that's how we've tried to develop our business, is just making sure that we're hearing what the guests are saying. So we had this thing where people would say, never change, keep it just the way it was, which was, you know, kind of rurally rustic and, you know, whatever. I mean, we didn't have some of the nicer pampering things like yoga or massage like we have now, but then you had other people, you know, leaving constant requests for, you know, why don't you have robes in the yurts or this or that, or, you know, it's like, so you've always got this tension of what people expect or want versus the other side of what people expect and want.
But it's interesting, because at that time when we opened 2004, the fall of 2004, there wasn't the word glamping wasn't out there. It we were right on the very cutting edge of that concept, and ecotourism was there, but it wasn't as popular as it is now. And it seemed like we hit this thing called pent-up demand, I think, which is people want to come to Big Sur, but a certain number of them want to stay in a place like this. Not everybody, but there's a certain number of them. That demand was pent up because it didn't exist. And then when it did, we were blessed with it taking off very rapidly, you know, being successful kind of right from the start.
I think people like to stay in something like a yurt or camp on the edge of the coast, you know, just to, so that they can rub their shoulders close to nature in a way that they wouldn't get from a normal hotel room. Yeah. And like John said, the word glamping didn't exist. So our first little brochure said something like, come stay in a yurt and feel close to nature, but in the comfort of a bed, you know, it would have been easier to say, we're a glamping resort, but there was no word. So it was like, you know, trying to describe it to people, you know, as quickly and as succinctly as we could. But, you know, definitely it's been something that our guests enjoy.
Yeah. How would you define the concept ecotourism or eco lodge or, you know?
Yeah. Well, for me, in dealing with some of the aspects of the housekeeping, and John can speak to the old, you know, the other aspects of our business, like the hard shell, the power and the water and the recycling and things. But, you know, trying to be very real about, you know, the use of paper in the rooms, or, you know, we offer these little pieces of soap that are organically made, you know, trying to offer products and do things in a way that are truly not as wasteful as other places, you know, in the city might be. Mm-hmm. And doing it in a real way, you know, not just a show way. You know, we've all been in hotel rooms that have lots of little pieces of paper all over saying, you know, we like to save water, so don't do this and don't do that. And all kind, you know, it's almost like the brochures themselves are more wasteful than than the actual end result of all their efforts can be.
Yeah, I don't think we didn't really set out to be an eco-tourism destination. That just is what we got defined as. But part of it was our original concept of perching lightly on the land. So you're staying in a unit that is doesn't have a lot of materials. A yurt has a simple frame and then a canvas exterior and a wooden floor. So it clearly has a lot less materials in it than your home. And you're comfortable, and you can hear the sounds from outside, but you're comfortable. That's part of it. The other part was we picked a very environmentally friendly power system at the time. So we did have some small solar at Tree Bones, but our main generator, we're off the grid. There's no grid here, but our main generator was a very clean burning California-based technology called Capstone Microturbines. And we used the turbines to generate power. We used the exhaust to heat the water for the pool, for the showers, for everything. And then just everything we tried to do was to not make any pollution and not clear out all the natural vegetation, just leave it the way it was. And it was immediately accepted as an eco destination. I don't think we understood that that was an intent that we needed to have, but all of our decisions have been made in that direction, including now that battery technology is so much better, we were able to put up large arrays of solar and store that energy and use it and use very little in the way of generators now.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that over the years, exactly what you said is that you have been making those decisions based on treading lightly, based on maybe even being kind of like an early adopter of new technologies that are facilitating exactly that kind of a thing. So in one way, maybe optimistically, you also can be educational in that way, and you can be inspirational to others to pursue those kinds of technologies and ways of minimizing your footprint.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when we first opened, I think people were spending more time looking at the website and maybe learning about a little bit more about us or infrastructure. As time goes on, people get busier and busier. They may not even realize some of our guests that were completely off grid. You know, we try to share that information because it's really quite amazing. And we all know anybody who lives and has a home in Big Sur that's off grid, you know, it's so amazing to think that it's possible to use solar and such to power your places. And I think there may be some other ways we could bring that back to the attention of our guests. Like I'm saying, people just get busy and they don't necessarily always study or know exactly about the places that they're landing.
I can testify myself as to how inspiring and educational and interesting it was to get a brief tour. John gave me a brief tour. You did, John, of your off the grid, fairly recent upgrades, and yes. That was quite interesting. And I'm thinking that your guests, I'm sure, would really enjoy that also.
Yeah, we don't. You know, it's interesting that we don't push it, but we offer it if people do want to see it, and we offer to share some of the experiences that we've had. So we have a organic garden here. And we compost our waste, and we have a tour, self-guided tour of the garden.
Food waste.
Yeah. But anyway, they could see the organic garden. And what's fascinating to me is if you can show that living in a simple structure, living off-grid, growing your own food, and living with nature isn't painful, I think what happens is people go, well, I could do that. I'm interested. So it does inspire. It's written into our vision statement that we want to be inspired and inspire the people that come to visit us. So they've given us ideas and we've been inspired by them, but we try to have them leave with an inspiration, a little bounce in their step saying, hey, we could be more environmentally friendly where we live and make that available. And we let people see it. But I honestly believe that the secret to that is to show that it's not painful, and we're not here suffering down here on the South Coast, like, barely making it. It's enjoyable. It's relaxing. It's tasty. It's warm, and it can still be environmentally friendly.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that, excuse me, later on today, I'm going to go down to my place of business and pick up four lithium batteries, because I'm just now changing from lead acid to lithium at my home, which I'm excited about for a lot of different reasons. But the prices have gone down to a level now where it is good for a small system like mine to change.
Right. Yeah. So we're even converting all of our golf carts. My son-in-law Caleb, who really runs the operations now, has initiated converting our golf carts to lithium iron phosphate batteries. And what's beautiful about them is they weigh less because the same amount of power can be in half the cells. And the other thing is you could draw them way down, whereas acid, you can't go below 11 volts, but you could draw these lithium iron phosphate down all the way to almost zero longer. So you're going to enjoy that.
Right. Yeah. You know, another thing that I think about when I think about Three Bones is your suppliers. I mean, it's the same for all of the businesses in Big Sur, even up here on the North Coast. But there is a distance for your suppliers to travel to get your supplies, like, for instance, fresh food for your restaurant, because I have had the pleasure of being in your restaurant several times and been very impressed with the offerings there. So what? Talk a little bit about those challenges and how that's been working out.
They normally, if the road is open from the north, our supplies often come from the north. Half of them come from the north and half of them come from the south. What's happened is with the road closure, our suppliers actually have been good enough to get lease or buy different trucks and come around and bring them a longer distance and bring them to us. And we haven't really missed out on any of the supplies. They want to keep us as a customer. And they'll compete to do that. That's a really a wonderful thing. And part of it has to do with, you know, we buy enough that it makes it worthwhile for them. But with the sushi bar and the lodge restaurant, it's, you know, a significant amount of food that we bring in.
Yeah. Yeah. So how about the Nacimiento Road? How much has that played in to your...
Well, that's been years where... you know, when both sides of the highway have been closed, of course, just like lots of other people that live in Big Sur, we've used that road and loved that road. Then as it deteriorated, you know, it got to be pretty sketchy, but I haven't personally used it recently. I love it. I love it when I'm forced to use that road when it's practical to use, because I love the drive.
Yeah.
It's the most, as you know, it's one of the most iconic drives you could ever do. And I'm just grateful that they're actually, it's Monterey County that's now repairing it. You know, they're doing one half and then the other half.
Yeah, and so. The Forest Service also got the money. So yeah. It is an amazing road. It's we sort of leave that for our neighbors right now, to tell you the truth, because for some of them that live mountains behind us, that is their only in and out.
Yeah.
And so they don't bring our guests over it anymore. And then we don't use it ourselves, really, because we can't always go out south and get where we need to go. So
I think some of our team members, our staff, use it if they're trying to connect with friends on the North Coast. You know, they'll try to, obviously it would be a lot faster to pop over Nasi and then go north. So it's still being used by some, but...
Yeah. Well, I've heard that you mentioned your sushi bar. I've heard that the people you have helping you run that sushi bar, that they go down like at 5 a.m. in the morning down to the shoreline, and they stand there and fish in the morning, and then they bring that fish up and it's freshly served in your sushi bar every single day. Is that true?
Some of that, yeah, some of that we have done, but still most of the fish still, you know, comes from a supplier that supplies sushi bars. But fortunately, the supplier we've always used comes from the south. So it comes from Santa Barbara or places south of us. And so we haven't interrupted our sushi service and or our regular restaurant service.
You know, that there was one thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, and that is your family and the amount of children that you have and grandchildren now. That because some things have recently happened. Your one of your boys just got married recently, and you had a grandchild recently, and that must be a good time.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. It's exciting. So all four of our children are married. This last year, Mike was married to Katie. They've been together for I think 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
And then our youngest, Camille, married her boyfriend as well. So, and we, you know, so that's really fun. And then, of course, Megan, our oldest, who's married to Caleb, has Cece, our granddaughter, and she's going to be turning 3 in January. And then our other son, Lucas, has his little boy, Lev. They live down in Morro Bay. He'll be turning 1 in January. So, and then we have another step granddaughter who's 6. So,
wow. Great.
All of our kids live, you know, in this general vicinity that we could get to their places in less than 2 hours at any time. So that's kind of an amazing thing that these days, where everyone is usually spread out.
Yeah, totally.
So
wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you know, we I am so grateful to you for spending the time talking with me. And this, of course, is intended to be shared with the community through the through the podcast. And I'm wondering if there is anything that either of you thought of that you wanted specifically to talk about or to share, because, like I said, eventually it'll be shared with the community what we are talking about.
Well, one thing I do want to just add, because I felt like we kind of pumped up our glamping and ecotourism business. That's not to say that all of the hotels and restaurants in Big Sur aren't also wonderful in their own way. And one of the neatest thing is that we're all so different. Everything we offer, every single hotel and restaurant in Big Sur offers something different than each other. And in such, I don't feel like this sense of competitiveness. I feel like a sense of cooperation between the businesses. And I think that's one of the special, special things about running a business in Big Sur, is that you're not sitting around trying to think about how you could beat the competition. That's not even entering into it. It's more of a realization that we're all different and we all have our own reasons for being. And so we enjoy staying at other places as well, just because sometimes we're in the mood for something different that way. And that's a point that I really wanted to make.
Yeah, there are enough. There are so many people in this world who have heard of or have been visiting Big Sur and wanting to come back. So the amount of customers is so great that I think that is, of course, also one of the reasons why you don't have to be thinking about competition, because you can easily probably fail your business, and everyone can. Looking at the occupation rate now at campsites and motels and hotels in Big Sur, it's very high.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful to be part of this community. I mean, I think we as a family we feel a great responsibility being a business in Big Sur that's family owned and run, that we want to contribute to the causes that are important to our community. And we've worked hard, even in times like this year when it's not a good year for us economically, but we still want to support the important things, the health center, Big Sur Fire, the River Run, the fashion show. And we put ourselves out there because we are a business and we're a source of revenue, and we want to make sure that we spread that as much as we can to our community. We love our community. We love living here. We love being part of it. And I hope it shows.
Oh, it has always shown, as far as I'm concerned. Your engagement with so many different aspects of the community work has been so apparent and so well received and appreciated. So there is little doubt that is there. And everybody's very thankful for that, I'm sure.
We miss being connected to the North Coast. And yet, in another sense, I think some people could also agree that, you know, having a bit more remoteness where we are is also very special. Like, we're both ends, the North and the South, are cul-de-sacs, basically.
Right.
And there's something to be said that's quite wonderful about that.
I mean,
it's, I think the road right down here right now probably feels like it did, 30 years ago, as far as, traffic on the road. And, there's no way you can't love that.
It would also seem to me that the guests that are now able to come to your place would also be there at a time when it's special, because of what you just mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. And guests have mentioned that it, a couple guests said, if you have a chance to come to Big Sur right now while the road is closed, do it. Feeling of how it was, decades ago. And we remember that too. We've been moving on this coast now for, 35 some odd years. So we remember the ways that it has been.
Yeah,
and I think everybody wants to tap back into that somehow. They, whether they come for a quick visit, they want a little feeling of what Big Sur is, but also what it was. you know.
Yes, yes. What is your capacity now as far as number of guests?
You know, we can run about 32 to 45, you know, 50 guests a night. So right now, today, actually, the funnest thing is we have, we've been doing these small yoga retreats with someone who's become a friend and an associate down in Cambria. And this is her 14th year up here. Wow. And so yesterday we had, I think 11 attendees check in and 2 yoga instructors. And it's just really a lovely time for them to be here. We started those retreats in January and February years ago. And now they've become so popular. We have 3 this December and then 2 more in February as well. And so what a special time for them to be here. You know, it's just, it's quiet, it's beautiful. They're being nurtured and they're, yeah, it's just a really nice time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does it look like right now when you look out the window?
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Partly cloudy, but just warm and sunny.
The ocean is sort of a grayish blue and the sky has got some white striplings. We've seen some, I'm not sure if the gray whales have started to come through yet, but we've seen some pods of dolphin out there over the last couple of days. Really, really cool. Really cool when they come through because really, you know, you'll look at something that looks like just a rough patch on the ocean. But if you look through a telescope, which we have in our living room, you can see that it's not a rough patch in the ocean, but it's hundreds and hundreds of dolphins moving along on the coast, on the water. And so it's a pretty interesting and fun thing to see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to say goodbye then, guys. Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you for doing this, Mavis.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
We've listened to many and just really appreciate who you are and what you have going on there at the Henry Miller. And thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.